This is Stellacast, episode 18, Catching Up with Mucho. All right, welcome back to Stellacast, four member extraordinaire Mucho Bocho. It's been a while. Mucho, how you doing?
Hello there.
It's good to hear from you. We've been trying to hook up for a while to do another podcast. You know, so today, just a few minutes ago, I was actually supposed to interview Kenji from the food lab from Serious Eats, and he came down with a migraine, so we had to reschedule for tomorrow. And I saw you answering some questions on the forum. I was like, I should text Mucho, see what he's up to, see if he wants to do a quick podcast.
Yeah, sounds good. It's a rainy day here in Raleigh, so this time's be great.
So what have you been working on lately?
Jacob loves to ask me that question.
I do, always.
It's very random. Depends on the mood and the weather and so forth. I've been cooking some char siu. I've been experimenting with a Vietnamese sandwich called banh mi. It's a pork. They have several different flavors, pork and chicken. But it's basically shredded pork meat in the bottom of a French baguette that has sort of a savory sauce with cucumber, jalapeno, and cilantro. So it also has this pickle of daikon and carrot. It's sweet and savory and tasty. I've been on a kick lately. We've got quite a few Vietnamese restaurants down here in Raleigh, and I've been trying to find my most favorite one.
Man, I love a good banh mi. In fact, I was doing some R&D on banh mi over the summer, and rice flour baguette, and doing the whole marinade. And like we were talking about in our email conversation back and forth, I have those recipes somewhere, and I should pull them up, and we should start testing them together. Because I was getting pretty close with the marinade and the roasting process. And the rice flour baguette I was actually really happy with as well, which was just your basic long and slow fermentation. And I substituted about 10% rice flour for the bread flour. And it came out pretty nice.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah, I've been fairly happy with what I've been able to produce. I have never had, I think, a very authentic version of it. So, and the ones that I've been making, they don't come, well, actually, the more traditional, I believe, is with pate. Do you make it with that, Jake?
Yeah, so they do the pork pate spread, which is really nice because it adds the creaminess to it all. And then, you have they'll also, traditional too, is head cheese, but it's a tighter version of head cheese. So it's not super gelatinous. It's the pork pate. They spread it on, then the slices of the head cheese, and then usually some form of roasted pork, or you'll see chicken as well. And then you have the pickled vegetables. I'm going through my notes right now. Here's a Vietnamese baguette. I'm trying to find my marinade, but yeah, I had a student out for our boot camp over the summer who owns a couple of restaurants in Philadelphia, and we helped him create a chicken banh mi that he could sell at the cafe, and it turned out to be a pretty big seller for him.
Nice. What kind of sugars were you using? I was experimenting with palm, which I would think would be most traditional, but...
Yeah, palm sugar is traditional. For his purposes, though, we were trying to limit specialty ingredients that didn't really have cross-utilization capabilities. And since that was his only real Vietnamese-flavored dish, we were just using... Yeah. A mixture of cane sugar and brown sugar, and really kind of getting our Vietnamese flavor structure from the use of fish sauce and tiny bit of soy, ginger, garlic, rice wine vinegar.
And you cook it on a flat top?
For that one, yeah, we did. So we were doing the boneless skin, the thighs, and we would marinate it in the fish sauce marinade. Then we'd pull it off, and then be like a 24-hour marinade, and then give it a quick char on the flat top. So then you have that nice smoky char flavor, and then we'd finish it in the oven because the flat top obviously was too hot to cook it all the way through. But it'd only take a second at that point to actually finish it.
And then chop it.
Yep.
Then chop it and put it on. Yeah. Okay. Nice. Sounds great.
Chop it and then do pickled vegetables, carrots. Let's see. I think we did carrot and daikon, and then cilantro, and then jalapenos, which some people do fresh, some people do pickled. We ended up actually slicing them thin on Japanese mandolin and doing a pickled. Mm-hmm. Because it took away the heat a little bit and it made it a little bit more universally palatable. Yeah. The problem with jalapenos is they can be all over the map on that Scoville scale.
Absolutely.
So pickling it just gave us a little bit more consistency.
So a lot of the pork that I see in the banh mi's around here, they have the sort of like a tinge of redness to them. Not redness in terms of being undercooked, but just in terms of the color. Not dark red like someone used a food coloring, but they have almost like a salmon type look to them.
I wonder if they're somehow doing it, they're creating a smoke ring. Maybe they're doing it like on a slow smoker. Hmm. You know what I'm talking about with like barbecue? You have that pink ring on ribs. Does it look like that?
No, it's almost between like a mustard color and a light rose, like a pinkish color. I'll take a photo of it. It's definitely a very well cooked, thin, very very thin piece of meat. The pork that I've had here has not been cooked and then chopped. It seems like it's just been sort of either hammered, but it's quite thin.
But you're talking the cross section of it is slightly pink, right?
No, the if you were to just take a piece out without actually, say breaking it per se, and it is in, strips and chunks. It's not like one large piece. It has almost a dark, between a light amber, like a mustardy. And it's hard to describe, but I'm not sure. Not sure if it's an ingredient they add. I've been trying to, trying to get the ingredients from these restaurants that I go to, but a lot of times very ethnic restaurants are very guarded.
Yep.
Almost offended when you try to inquire how they made it. So it makes me smile. I mean, I feel the same way you do about sharing and sort of, all working together and learning and having fun and, this kind of thing. But it is when I find somebody that I always feel is like, they've discovered something that no one has ever, we've had this conversation, we talked about Chick-fil-A trade secrets, those things make sense, but, when someone's doing Peruvian chicken and they're cooking it in a rotisserie oven and it's paprika and lemon and vinegar, but you'd like to know what temperature they use their oven or did they pre-marinate, did they brine any of that stuff.
A lot of it too is especially the Asian ethnic food is very condiment based. So, it's all about mixing and matching condiments and spices. And so, if sometimes it's that key little ingredient that you're missing that kind of takes it to that authentic hole in the wall level that you're trying to recreate.
Yeah.
And, they know that. And that's why they have to be guarded with it because, people will travel for that char siu pork. People will travel for that perfect Neapolitan pizza dough, And so there's these little secret tricks that, maybe you don't want to give up, which, I'm in the business of sharing information, but I understand why people would be guarded with that.
Do you ever mess around with rice? Rose water.
Oh yeah. Uh huh. It's good. We would put it in some of our like Asian style sauces because it gives you that complex. Aromatics, and it actually goes. So if you're doing anything with like a Szechuan peppercorns, you know, this little spritzer of orange water to finish, it gives a really nice floral element.
Yeah, that's I've been messing around using that in some. In fact, I added some of that to the char siu. You know, just a little splash. I think it's mostly with Indian cooking though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll see it a lot in Indian cuisine, kind of that whole like North African region. You'll see it. You know, speaking of Szechuan peppercorns too, when I was in Philadelphia recently, I went to a restaurant called Han Dynasty, and there's a few of them, but it's a Szechuan food, and it was just they had these dishes that would just light you on fire, but it was so damn good. And they had this one. It was a chilled like Szechuan rabbit, and you know, it was so heavy on the Szechuan peppercorns, but very nicely balanced. And you know, when I would take a sip of water to kind of cool my mouth down, I would get these really floral aromas coming from the Szechuan peppercorn that was lingering, and it kind of tasted like rose and orange peel. So
yeah, it's wonderful. I have some, and I use it occasionally. I have probably, like you, so many different traditional peppers as well as chilies and variations of the two, some smoked, some salted. So, you know, those things can impact it. I will say, though, that I think in the past year, I've shifted to trying to simplify my cooking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. You know, and simplify doesn't necessarily mean to make it any easier to cook, but it does mean to try to get to where you're focusing on a very clear flavor profile that doesn't require a lot of times multiple steps and more ingredients. You know, really trying to reduce things down. I find that oftentimes to be pretty tough to do.
Yeah, and I think that's an important evolution too in cooking is finding that simplicity. You know, and you'll see that a lot in the higher end restaurants, and that's one of the reasons why they prefer to do multi-course dinners, because you can't really have, you know, an entree size portion made up of three or four ingredients. It was just, you'd quickly become bored with it. But when served you in a two or three bite course, you can really sort of showcase how a couple of different focused ingredients play off of one another. And the same thing is true when you scale that up and just, like you said, make a concerted effort to be more focused on your flavor structure and on what you're doing in the first place, because it gets, you know, I mean, you go through an experimental phase where you just want to, just throw everything together and see what happens and keep on adding and keep on adding. And then sometimes when you decide, okay, I'm going to pull back and simplify, you not only get better results, but I think also too, it comes later in the evolution of being a cook, because there's no room for error. You know, you don't have, I mean, I'll see it a lot in professional cooking. You know, the younger chefs will have these recipes that are, you know, you have like a 30 ingredient spice rub, and their dishes have like five different colored sauces that they swoop and swoosh and all that stuff. And it looks, you know, really interesting and beautiful on the plate, and they have 20 different flavors going on. And it's like, oh, you're just trying to hide the fact that you're not confident in this dish. You know, because if you take, say, a chicken and a couple of spices or a couple of herbs, it could be absolutely wonderful, but that chicken has to be perfectly roasted. The herbs or the spices have to be perfectly balanced. So it actually takes a higher degree of technicality.
Mm, that's a good point. I never really thought about it like that, but yeah, it's in the dishes that I've been cooking where I would normally have maybe several different spices, and then I would be kind of looking to see, you know, what could I make it, you know, a little more secret spice, you know, do I want to throw, like, let's just say tacos, You know, so, you know, we're a big fan of tacos in my house, and, you know, I make the ground beef filling. That's that traditional sort of red spicy kind of beef filling, and then, you know, whatever goes on top of it. Well, you know, I'm a big fan of having lots of different types of toppings. At one time, you know, I was doing pickled vegetables, of course, some lettuce, cilantro, limes, cheese. You know, I've put pickled beets on them, and then of course all the different sauces that you could go: taco sauce, you know, vinegar-based sauce, hot spicy sauces. Mm-hmm. You could go Asian with it. I mean, so there's so many things that you can. So a couple of times, the past times when I've made tacos, I look at all the condiments and accoutrements that were created, and if you did put all that on a taco, or even half of that, it would be, all of the flavors would not be able to be appreciated as if you only presented, say four or five different condiment options and did them properly, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. And have that balance and that interplay of flavors. It's kind of like when you're, you know, when you first learn how to mix colors, you know, using the color wheel, and then you just keep on mixing, and you eventually end up at brown. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's kind of what happens with flavors. You go overboard with mixing too many different flavors together, and eventually you just end up at brown. And it's just, there's not really anything that is contrasting or that jumps out at you. So, I mean, I remember when I first started cooking, I had a chef tell me, you know, Jacob, when you create a dish, you know, just put your dish together and choose two ingredients to leave off next time because they probably don't belong there in the first place. Mm. And, you know, I mean, a lot of times he was right. And it was more just, it wasn't a hard and fast rule, but it was more just being like, hey, you know, be conscious of the fact that you can sometimes, it's natural to become overzealous with the amount of ingredients you add to a dish. And, you know, usually the most genius dishes I've had in restaurants in the past have been, you know, fairly focused.
You know, it's interesting. I think it really, a lot of times, has to have to do with the type of cooking, or the ethnicity of cooking, right? Let's, mm-hmm. you know, let's compare that with Indian food, right? I mean, you know, I don't think any of us have ever had a curry that didn't have, you know, at least 30 ingredients or 40 ingredients, right? It wasn't, you know, cooked over time, developed those, you know, those complex flavors. You know, so it's
yeah, but in that case, well, there are actually it's crazy when you start actually diving into India food or Indian food, because India is such a massive country. Mm-hmm. And so what makes it stateside for us is just a very small sliver stylistically of what they do. And there are some curries that are actually fairly simple, you know, curry just being a mix of spice. So once you have a couple of spices in the pot, you didn't have a curry. But there's something to be said. I mean, one of the things that I talk about is what I call a spectrum of flavor. And that is, you know, so you take something like a beet, and you know, you can take that beet and roast and make a roasted beet salad. Now, if you take those stems from the beet and you pickle them, and then you take the greens and then you turn them into a pesto, then you take, you know, maybe a portion of, you know, you just take golden beets and you poach them in apple cider, and then you take the red beets and you roast them, and you take the candy cane beets and maybe you char them in the wood fire or something. So then what you end up with, instead of having one single expression of that beet, whether it be roasted or boiled, you now have multiple expressions of that beet, but it's the same ingredient being expressed in different ways. And so what that does is it'll give you a spectrum of flavor to where when you're tasting on the same plate these different forms of the beet together, you're enjoying all these different expressions that beet can be. But you still have the overall flavor of, hey, I'm eating a beet salad. So that's why it actually, number one, works and doesn't get too complicated. But you kind of see the same thing with curries. A lot of the curries, you know, they may have 30 ingredients in them, but you're still going to have maybe, two to three predominant flavors that you can actually pick out. And then the rest are just background hints of complexity that are just almost as a, you know, building a foundation or a stage for those three main ingredients in that curry to shine.
Yeah, that's a good point. One interesting thing that I learned recently in that, at least in the Indian restaurants that I've eaten in the United States, a few different states, coast to coast, they've always offered naan and usually rice with the curries, or, you know, rice is a general common a side dish to Indian dishes. But that is very much an American thing, that in the North, they have naan, and in the South, they have rice, and it kind of meets in high somewhere in the middle of the country, but rice is considered more peasant, and naan is considered a little bit more highbrow.
That makes sense. Because you need the refined flours to create the naan. Whereas rice, you just have the grain that you can boil.
Of course. And, you know, we know over time that flour and how it's been refined is, it's about the cooking, of course, and about the flavor to some degree. But it also has to do with a culture of development, of a sort of an upper class that we're able to afford. White refined bread and a lot of interesting ways at how food evolves and culture evolves, you know, with that food.
Yeah, absolutely. And, and of course, as being Americans, we're like, oh, we don't care. We want rice and the naan. Just
of course. We're gonna grab the rice with the naan.
Yeah, give me everything. I'll take one of each.
Yeah. So speaking of cultural foods too, kind of seems like it's our topic on this call. I make this form of Portuguese soup. My grandparents are from the Azores. It's an island way off the coast of Portugal. It's akin to the way Sicilians are toward Italy. They really do consider themselves to be kind of a unique culture. And so they make a form of Portuguese soup that is much more like a stew than an actual soup. It's Caldo Verde would be a sort of a higher brow, refined form of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is more of a kind of a country style. It's a sort of a more for the people type stew. It starts with a base of it's a pork base. A lot of times you use some kind of a smoked hawk, or this time I happen to have tails and trotters and pork necks, and then you basically just make a very thick collagenous soup, that stock rather, that then you build up with the beans we've always used were they call it 15 bean. It's kind of a hodgepodge of all the different beans mixed in a bag. And those are actually cooked dry, dumped right into to hot water, hot stock rather, and with some mirepoix. I cook those for about an hour or so, add about a couple of lentils, let those cook through, and then it gives you a kind of a brothy, kind of a thick, rich, sort of a greenish pork based, almost like a like a split pea soup. And then to that you add chuck, you add bits of pork. I was using country ribs with some bone on it. You want to cook those in the water through till they're tender. The chuck might take over an hour or more. The pork usually done a little less. So pull that off. Slice up some chorizo sausage. So it's not chorizo, which is different than the Portuguese based sausage, which is either linguiça or chorizo.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the chorizo has more chili pepper and cumin in it, where the Portuguese based sausage is more cayenne pepper based. a cayenne pepper and paprika based. And so you throw that sausage in there, kind of get all that warmed up. And then to finish it off, you chop up again another round of mirepoix, cabbage, and copious amounts of kale. I mean, kale to fill both of your sinks.
Okay.
Like, you can't have enough kale in this. Strip out the ribs, chop them or break them up with your hands, and then so you put that in just to finish it. So you end up with a very sort of thick stew consistency. It's rich with the beans that have cooked through. They're fairly soft now. The meat is very tender. It's in sort of pieces inside it. And of course, the one thing that makes it very special is you season it with spearmint.
Really?
Yeah. So it you take a you take really a pork based soup that has a mix of meats in it and beans for the thickness, and of course tons of vegetables, and this spearmint is it just brings it into it to another whole level of complexity. The way that it intermingles, you know, Jacob, I'll usually hit it with a good shot of vinegar when I'm, you know, before I'm about to serve it to kind of bring everything up. But yeah, it's this Azorean Portuguese soup, and I can post the recipe.
That'd be pretty
straightforward. You know, it's a full afternoon old world cook soup that you would make in a huge vat, and basically, you know, you'd leave it in the refrigerator, and you know, I as a kid would have it in there for a week or two, just, you know, nipping at it whenever I was hungry. It's because it has so much antioxidants in it, and it's so rich in collagen and fat that it has a fairly long shelf life.
So are you using the spearmint more as a garnish so it stays fresh, or are you actually cooking the spearmint into the soup itself?
Yeah, I cook the spearmint into the soup. So kind of a Paul Prudhomme thing that I picked up along the way, especially using dried herbs, is I like to season in the beginning, in the middle, and then kind of as a finish at the end, just to, so that you capture the flavor of that herb, not only cooked, but also mildly cooked, and then, as you know, somewhat fresh.
Yeah, that spectrum of flavor we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Are you using dry spearmint then?
This is dry. Yeah, I've done both, but I think this gives it a bit more and it's spearmint, not peppermint. The spearmint gives it just that because the soup is so complex and it has so many rich warm flavors in it. The spearmint sort of brings everything up and kind of cuts through it. It doesn't taste the same without it, even though you have a lot of the same ingredients.
If you could post a recipe of that soup, and I'll drop it into this episode show notes, that'd be great, because I know people would definitely dig that. So, I mean, it sounds a lot like a Caldo Verde, but just more country style, more rustic, and with the and you're using the beans really as almost like a thickener. Yeah,
exactly. Lentils are amazing thickener, and you know, they take almost no time.
Mm-hmm.
I've had it in the past with potatoes, and you would think potatoes would be potatoes and garlic would be sort of a nice combination to this soup, but I found leaving those two ingredients out create a different profile that I think makes it a little richer without the potato kind of sort of light fluffiness. I don't think that the garlic is necessary to add to the profile of it. Sure, there's some in the linguiça, but mm-hmm. You know, not to add it actually as an ingredient.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I'll have to whip up a batch and check it out, because I love a good soup, and on my mom's side, we have a pretty deep Portuguese lineage. My great-grandmother was actually full Portuguese, so I remember when I was young, you know, she'd always cook these from-scratch meals that were just very simple and rustic, but absolutely delicious.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is one of those, back of the stove kind of, working a little here, working a little there throughout the day. You know, it doesn't require a lot of skimming and straining and fuss. The broth can be, as cloudy as muddy water. The spearmint really adds a dimension, and it's one of the things specifically I remember my grandmother stressing to my mom, when I was, who knows how old, that, spearmint was, and this, God, 35 years ago, spearmint was not so common in grocery stores. I mean, let's face it. And so it was always one of those things where they would grow it in the throughout the spring and summer and try to harvest it, and of course drying spearmint, unless you have a nice dehydrator, it turns brown and it's not so pretty, but it usually holds its flavor.
Now, I just saw on the forums too, you updated your post on, what was it? You did some copa and some pancetta, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just pulled those.
Yeah, tell me about those.
Yeah, they're great. So we can talk about the process.
Let's talk about your copa process.
Okay, so it was pretty straightforward. I took and deboned a pork shoulder. I used the side of the pork shoulder that holds the copa, so it's a muscle grouping in the barbecue world. They call it the money muscle. Mm-hmm. It's approximately, as you know, Jacob, it's approximately a third of the entire pork butt. It's usually on the opposite end of where the H-bone is, or that bone that's usually in your pork butts. Sometimes they remove those. It's usually on the opposite end of that, and it's a round muscle grouping that is absolutely perfect in anything you could want it for. In fact, folks out there that are making their own barbecue, I would strongly suggest removing the copa for another use and then using the rest of the meat that is in the butt for your barbecue. It's essentially a three.
Just to clarify, so when people buy the whole pork shoulder, you're saying that's remove the money muscle to use for your copa, and then use that pork shoulder for your barbecue or whatever else you're doing, right?
Absolutely, or at the very least, take that money muscle, that copa off. It kind of looks like a bit of a football. It has the meat has a very unique ratio of fat to meat, and the meat is the darker meat in the pork. Mm-hmm. When you get a pork butt, as it's going to have lots of different muscles. Most of it is going to be of that lighter quality. You're looking, and when you are at the grocery store, you're always looking for a darker, richer color of your pork. You take that copa muscle just like you would most other sort of semi-cured meats. You go through a three-step process. The first step is largely the cure, and that is to pretty much season them with salt. You rub that all over the meat, and then you would put that in a bag. In my case, I vacuum bagged that under a very tight seal, and every day or so I would massage it. I basically let it set up in that cure, which is a combination of salts and peppers, sodium nitrite, sodium erythorbate, and some of the other sausage-type ingredients that I add to that. And then you essentially let that muscle cure. Remove it at that point. Rinse it down really well. What I like to do, so I left it in the cure for, I think it was 10 days. You just leave it in the refrigerator. It's pretty straightforward. Take it out, rinse it off, soak it for about 15-20 minutes in water. The soaking process will allow you to add moisture to the meat that you're curing, balance off the salt flavors, and give you overall better color and better curing as you move into the next stages. What happens a lot of times when you salt something, you're intensely concentrating that salt on the outside of that ingredient. And if you were to then simply wipe it off or just rinse that off, you'd still have a very high concentration of salt on the outside. And over time, as it dries, that salt will harden. And therefore, the moisture on the inside of the product won't be allowed to escape. You'll have essentially what amounts to a salt shell on your cured meat. And then that meat won't cure properly. Not only will it be salty on the outside, it could also be bad on the inside. So you want to let that copa sit in the water for a little while. Water is really important ingredient in cooking. I think a lot of people don't spend enough time thinking about the type of water that they use in most of the cooking, from salt, from soups to stocks to gravies and so forth. I do use distilled water or very purified bottled water, certainly for boiling things and so forth. Regular tap water, as long as it's not too chlorinated, can be fine. So then after you take that mussel in the water, it's sat for a little while, take it off, dry it off good, then let it hang for about a day or so. That's kind of the sort of second step, is to dry the mussel. Then in this case, which I haven't done in the past, is I stuffed it into a beef bung. Mm-hmm. A beef bung is a part of the cow that is after the small intestines, between the small intestines and the large intestines. The small intestines actually has two different sizes. One is the small intestines. One is what they call the middles. So a beef bung, you can think of it basically as a 4-inch diameter by 18-inch long bag that is incredibly strong. You can almost like a cat gut type of a setup. It's highly matrixed. It's very, very tough. And so what you do is you cut off a portion of it that you're looking to use. The bung is really a long bag, so it's closed on one end and open on the other end. And so in this case, I really just had a 4-pound copa that you want to stuff in that bung. But before you stuff it, then you really want to season it. And this is a critical phase when you're curing meats, because you have to introduce sugar along the process of curing meat, because that's what your bacteria is going to consume in order to go through that that natural aging process. In this case, I used dehydrated glucose syrup, which is basically glucose powder. That all over the copa. I used a mix of paprika and a few other traditional Italian spices. Rub that all over the actual meat and then stuff that in the copa. For the top of it, I kind of just used some kitchen twine and a big needle. Mm-hmm. Stitched that closed, and then I hung that, as you can see it on the way, for about 3 weeks. You could certainly go a lot longer. It's hung at about 75 degrees relative temperature with maybe about 50% humidity.
Okay.
And you're aiming to drop that mussel about 15 to 20% weight.
And how are you controlling your humidity? Because looking at your pictures, it looks like you're just hanging it in like a room or a walk-in closet. Where are you hanging that?
I have a small, what amounts to commode.
Uh-huh.
in an unused bathroom that has the ventilation from the window. So and we're also in the winter months in North Carolina, so the humidity is up is kind of fairly stable anyway.
Okay.
So then I did that copa for about 3 weeks there, and the last final stage is just to bring out a little bit more moisture. I'll wrap it in a wax paper and leave it in the refrigerator for 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that will slowly allow more moisture to be released and kind of bringing it all together, keeping it, you know, nice and firm. And then at that point, the cope is still curing. The pancetta is pretty much done. And the pancetta was done pretty much the same way, only it didn't quite sit in the refrigerator. It won't quite sit in the refrigerator as long.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking at that post, and I mean, obviously the pancetta looks good, but I'm really looking forward to seeing how the cross section on that copa turned out, because hanging, it looks beautiful.
It is pretty. It's I've never worked with bung before. This is the first time I've been making the dry cured meats and shelf room stable shelf products for 5-8 years now, and I never actually used the beef bung, but it's good. In fact, I think I'm gonna do my next pancettas in the beef bung, because I think it will allow me to age them a little bit longer. And the meat, as you see it there, it's still fairly new. Mm-hmm. You could certainly age those pancettas, you know, for, you know, many, many, many more months. They were getting to be fragrant, and not having them kind of in my proper curing chamber, and it's one of those things where, you know, you got to kind of call it and see what you got, you know.
Right. Absolutely. So if you could, do you have? Is it easy for you to write up the ingredients that you used for your copa?
Oh yeah, no, I have it. One thing I use on my pancetta is, wonder if you work with Jacob, is a long pepper.
No, I haven't worked with that.
Absolutely, totally nothing else like it out there. It's you know, it's like saffron on like turmeric. That there just isn't anything that has a bouquet. So it's the stamen on an Amorphous phallus plant that they dry. You know, Amorphous phallus is that usually Christmas seasonal indoor plant that has that nice little white flower with mm-hmm. that sort of bumpy little protruding thing, you know, the phallus. And so they dry those. I think they're out of Madagascar. I'm not exactly sure, but they're really a very unique ingredient. They lend a unique bouquet. Kind of like we were talking about earlier about rose water. Mm-hmm. It's just something about it, and it has the foreground, the middle, and the background flavor that is there, but you may not be able to put your finger on. So I use those along with the pepper blend that I use for the pancettas.
Interesting, and it looks so. I mean, the pictures that I pulled up, it looks like you can see it's a dried stamen. Does it usually come in a long stick like that?
Yeah.
And you just mm-hmm. microplane it?
No, I toast it in a pan and put it in the mortar and pestle.
Okay.
You just hammer it. You know? Just kind of the whole thing.
Nice. Okay. That's fun. I'm going to have to add that.
Do you have like a Penzies out there or something like that?
No, but I'm sure I can just order online, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I'll definitely order some in and try and play with it a little bit, because that looks like fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. I always love finding new ingredients to mess around with.
I know. It is fun. One thing maybe we should do it looks like we've had some posts on sort of garlic sauces and, you know, uses for garlic, and, you know, I'm a real big fan of confit garlic.
Uh-huh.
Now, in fact, I would argue I don't even chop garlic anymore. You know, the beauty of confit garlic, which is essentially garlic roasted in oil, usually done in a jar or slow cooked on the stove, but I do mine in a pressure cooker. And when it cools, it comes out a consistency of almost a jelly. The pieces pieces hold their form, but they're soft. You could spread it very easily on toast or anything flat. And so I think it would be fun, you know, if we talked to the, you know, we did something on, you know, just garlic. And there's so many forms that folks can make. You know, post on garlic sauce, which I think is, you know, really fun. And just a side note, I came across that article and I really like what they were talking about. And I don't know if you, Jacobs, had a chance to look down in it, but you know, they cited some of the stuff that you were doing on emulsions and I thought that was pretty cool. And that was not planned.
Oh, they're referencing my emulsion videos?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting. A couple of links throughout the article, I don't know if you know those folks, but I thought they were right on.
That's funny. I'll check that out. Yeah, you know, I think what we should do, and this is up to you, because you could easily just post post something to the forum. But what happens with that is just over time, it kind of gets eaten up by other forum topics. And so what I think we should do is just give you the proper permissions with your account to write blog posts. So then when you do something a little bit more research oriented and less conversational, you know, like on the garlic confit, you know, you can write something up and then we can talk about it on a future episode of Stellacast to bring it to everybody's attention. Because I think the both the confit garlic project and also, you know, going back and forth on the char siu and the banh mi definitely have legs. I think other people would appreciate, you know, playing along.
Great. Yeah, that would be awesome. I mean, we can take photos and we can do a, you know, work in progress and you know, really get into some of the details. And then hopefully at the bottom, you know, we can get folks to, you know, get some feedback. We can put some recipes there. Mm-hmm. You know, I can, you know, we can both chime in and, you know, at offer advice and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you want to – let's go ahead and knock out confit garlic first. We'll make it on both of our ends. And why don't we – what we'll do is let's have you just do your post on confit garlic, how you make it, and that will start the conversation. And then I'll make some on my end, and then maybe other folks can who are listening and read the post, they can make some. And then we can just kind of brainstorm together, almost have like a confit garlic throwdown and see what we come up with for the uses.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, cool. Well, Mucho, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. I look forward to the future R&D projects, and we'll definitely get you back on. It's been too long, and you know, with what you've been working on and kind of the direction that we're taking Stella Culinary, you know, I'd like to get you on at least once a month on Stellacast to keep you updated on what you're doing. Because if we wait any longer than that, you've already moved on to your next project.
That's a lot of fun, Jake. I love the forum and I love people that love food. So any way that I can share, I'm in.
And there goes Mucho Bocho, Stella Culinary Forum member extraordinaire. Hey, look, we were talking about doing a contest of some sorts. If you want to play along at home, check out this episode's show notes, stellaculinary.com/scast18. And I will post some sort of contest there. Yeah. Not sure what yet, but if you play along, you can win one of our new Stella Culinary t-shirts. 4 designs to choose from. They are not even available for sale yet. So you will be one of the first people to even get a Stella Culinary t-shirt. Who knows? It could be a collector's item. Probably not, but hey, I'll send it to you anywhere in the world just for kicking ass and taking names in this competition. And next episode, episode 19, we will be having a special guest, J. Kenji Lopez Alt, Managing Culinary Director of Serious Eats and the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. So I will see you guys in the next episode. Later.